Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This is Here and Now. As Americans were celebrating Thanksgiving, North Korea was testing a large multiple rocket launcher, firing two short-range missiles into the sea. North Korea and the U.S. have been unable to make progress on a deal that would reduce economic sanctions on North Korea in exchange for North Korea abandoning its nuclear ambitions. We're joined now by NPR correspondent Anthony Kuhn in Seoul, South Korea. Anthony, welcome.
Hey, Jeremy.
So President Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un have been back and forth on nuclear talks for a long time now. Where are we with the situation at this moment?
One way of looking at it is that we are 30 plus days before the year's end and a North Korean deadline. Kim Jong-un has basically said if the U.S. does not offer up fresh concessions by the end of the year, he may just give up on nuclear negotiations with the U.S. altogether and go back to testing nuclear weapons and missiles. And that is, needless to say, very worrisome. That takes us back to where we were in 2017.
Except that there will have already been a couple of visits with the president of the United States, which is a change from where we were before that in terms of the relationship with North Korea. They've already gotten something that they wanted.
That's right. The sort of nuclear brinkmanship was in 2017 with Trump threats of fire and fury. Then that was followed by a year of diplomatic breakthroughs, starting with the U.S.-North Korea summit in Singapore in 2018, and then three inter-Korean summits. And then this year, a summit between Trump and Kim again in Hanoi in February that fell apart. And a Trump and Kim meeting at the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas in which President Trump actually stepped into North Korea. Now, talks have been stalled most of the rest of the year through that. Working level negotiations resumed in Stockholm last month, but they quickly fell apart.
Do you think that before the end of the year that a deal or another nuclear summit with President Trump looks likely?
Looks like a very long shot at this point. The U.S. is saying, we didn't make this deadline. It's got nothing to do with us. North Korea put that deadline on itself. And North Korea is saying, you know, we don't want a summit if it's just going to be a formality. We don't want any sort of meeting that doesn't give us concrete benefits. So they seem to have made the preparations to just let the clock run out, possibly on the year and possibly on the entire Trump administration. They may just wait until the next one.
Well, and Anthony, if this whole process after all this time and all this work fails, what's going to be the reason for that?
Well, the two sides just had a completely different view of, you know, what the end goal was. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has always seen complete, irreversible and verifiable denuclearization as the final state. North Korea intends to hang on to its weapons, but perhaps freeze them or give away a part of them in exchange for sanctions relief and some security guarantees. So they're starting out from different objectives, and they're you know, they just have not narrowed the differences through talks.
And obviously, a big part of the equation is South Korea, and I want to ask you about that. The U.S. is asking South Korea to pitch in $5 billion next year for U.S. troops that are stationed in the country, have been stationed in the country for a long time. South Korea paid less than $1 billion this year. How did the U.S. and South Korea get into this tiff?
Well, there were talks, but the two sides' positions were so far apart that the U.S. walked out on its ally and the talks collapsed. Hmm. Now, the Trump administration wants all of its allies to pay more, and South Korea is first in its sights, and then they're going to try the same thing on Japan and probably allies in Europe. And President Trump has suggested that some of the 28,500 troops here in this country could be withdrawn if Seoul does not pay up. Actually, Congress passed a law saying that the president can only take out a few thousand troops, beyond which he needs to get the Secretary of Defense to certify that that's actually in the nation's security interest to do. What people in South Korea are saying is that the U.S. has not been clear about how this $5 billion breaks down or what the rationale for it is. And if it turns out that what they're asking for is actually more than the cost of basing those troops then critics are going to accuse the U.S. of treating its allies as cash cows, mm-hmm. treating alliances as sort of for-profit enterprises and treating U.S. troops as mercenaries.
So does it seem likely, I'll ask you the same question I did about North Korea, does it seem likely that the U.S. and South Korea are going to agree on a deal here?
Well, I think a deal is possible. You know, we don't know if the U.S. really expects to get $5 billion or if it's just a sort of a bargaining ploy and they'll settle for two or three. Last year, they asked for a 50% increase and they got an 8% increase. And that is because South Korea is a democratic country. Any deal that is made has to be ratified by lawmakers, by their national legislature. And they got this 8% increase because the legislators said, well, that's what we're going to increase our national defense budget by. So that's okay. But this time, lawmakers have said, if this deal is not fair, we're not going to ratify it.
You just visited Camp Humphreys, which is at the heart of a lot of the cost-sharing issue. It's the largest U.S. military base on the peninsula. It's actually the largest U.S. base outside of the United States. What did you find there?
I found Popeyes. I found Arby's. I found 24-hour gyms. I found modern three-bedroom apartments for military families. I found a place that could look, you know, very much like any town USA. So this place is an area the size of downtown Washington, D.C. It just goes on and on. And in the event of another war with North Korea, this would become a massive staging base for moving troops and equipment onto the peninsula. And it's about an hour's drive south of Seoul in a city called Pyeongtaek, which is now really taking off with this base there. What I also saw was that this gigantic base is now a big fat target. When they made the decision to move to Camp Humphreys more than a decade ago, North Korean artillery and rockets couldn't hit it. Now they can hit just about anything on the entire peninsula. So the move seems like a good decision for peacetime. You get economies of scale. You save money on logistics. You get better living conditions from the soldiers. But, you know, it is a big fat target, and the U.S. really can only rely on deterrence to keep it from getting hit.
Now, I want to just ask you, Anthony, because before moving to Seoul, you spent many years as NPR's correspondent in Beijing. And there's been so much going on in China recently. Let me first ask you what you make of the developments in Hong Kong with these pro-democracy protesters. It's been going on for months now, demanding that they get to keep and even expand the democratic aspect of their society. And Beijing really wants to move them closer to how the rest of China is.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I was there for reporting mostly during June and August, and that was when you had the biggest marches, when they got as many as 2 million people into the streets of Hong Kong. And it was all nonviolent. And I think that's what, up until now, has had the biggest political impact and led to the withdrawal of this extradition bill that was the immediate cause of the protests. Now things are a lot more desperate and a lot more violent. No side shows any sign of giving in. I think everybody agrees that the matter can only be solved through political negotiations, not street violence, not law enforcement, but it's not happening. Now, some people may say, well, the only thing Beijing can do is intervene militarily, and that would be too much of a blot on their international reputation. But think about 1989 and Tiananmen Square. If they feel that their survival as a regime is threatened, they'll take the blot on their international reputation and put the protest down. No hesitation.
Okay. Well, speaking of Beijing feeling like their regime is threatened, let's talk finally about the Uyghurs. These are Muslims living in the Xinjiang region of China, and Beijing has been putting them into camps and prisons over the last 3 years, a million of them. Is this a human rights tragedy unfolding before our very eyes?
It certainly is, but in a sense, it's bigger than that. In a sense, it really is like Hong Kong. Both of them are regions on China's periphery. Both of them have pro-independence movements that Beijing is very worried about. And both of them are, in a sense, minorities. The Uyghurs speak a sort of Turkic language, and people in Hong Kong, many of them speak Cantonese. Documents obtained by the New York Times make clear that this was indeed a very sweeping campaign targeting Islamic extremism. Orders were given to round up whoever needs to be round up. This came from the very top of the system, President and party boss Xi Jinping, and that Xi Jinping had some really ideological goals in mind. And there are other countries that target radicalism and try to deprogram radicals. But as the report from the New York Times made clear, they tried to treat extremism as a disease and cure people of it. And this happened with apparently a lack of due process in violation of China's own laws outside the court system. And it appeared to make no distinction between radical Islam and simple religious devotion, expressed in things such as praying five times a day, eating halal, or wearing veils and growing beards.
Well, and I was asking an expert here in the U.S. about it recently, and I asked, you know, if the United States really put pressure on China to back off in Xinjiang, would they do it? And he said, no, they don't care. This is about their regime and their power all across the country in China.
Yeah. And as I said, like Hong Kong, they're concerned about an independence movement there. It's a cultural minority. It's a linguistic minority. It has not always been part of the Chinese nation. So that's a matter of sovereignty and regime survival to them.
That is NPR's Anthony Kuhn, who was the correspondent in China and is now based in Seoul, South Korea. Anthony, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.